Early in the last century, an unassuming guy with a prominent overbite would go on to become one of the world's first media superstars. His name, Robert Ripley. On Tuesday, the PBS American Experience program takes a look at the life of Ripley, the man who coined the phrase and the franchise, Believe It or Not. We're joined by the Ripley Entertainment VP of Exhibits and Archives, Edward Meyer. He is the keeper of Ripley's collection, past and present, and is interviewed in the PBS American Experience series. He's here to talk to us about this unusual man who launched a franchise that is now 100 years old. Edward Meyer, thanks for being with us today.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having us on so early in the new year.
Essentially, you're kind of like the Robert Ripley for the Ripley Entertainment franchise today. Is your method of acquiring items and stories different from what Ripley himself did?
Well, I guess I am the closest thing we have to Robert Ripley. Must distinguish there that, you know, first and foremost, Robert Ripley was a newspaper illustrator. He drew the Believe It or Not cartoon, and I can't draw, you know, a circle, absolutely no artistic talent. But in other ways, my main job is to acquire the exhibits that go into our 31 museums around the world. And I like to think that I do it a little similar to Rip. Of course, technology has changed the way we work considerably since his time, but Ripley was called the modern Marco Polo. He traveled to 201 countries. I haven't been to anywhere near that many, but I'm a well-traveled guy, and we search the world for the odd and the unusual.
Well, you mentioned that Ripley was an illustrator. He started his career, I think some people might be surprised by this, as a sports cartoonist. What was he doing when he first came up with this whole Believe It or Not idea?
I think it's hard for people to realize today, with everybody having a camera phone in their pocket, but there was a time where newspapers had illustrations as opposed to photographs. And Ripley is at the, I'd say, at the height of that era when every newspaper worth its weight had a major illustrator that would write the stories of the day. And the newspaper might have one photograph on the front page, and that was it. Well, he started, art was his hobby, and his passion was baseball. And he wanted to be a baseball player. He was playing semi-pro ball in Santa Rosa, California. His first job with the newspapers is in San Francisco, and he's out there for a couple years, but everybody's telling him that, you know, if you really want to pursue your baseball career, you gotta go to New York. And so he moves to New York at the end of 1912 and actually goes to spring training, has a tryout with the New York Giants in 1913, and probably would have made the team, but broke his arm in about eight places during a spring training game, thus ending his baseball career. And now he's 3,000 miles from home, doesn't know anybody, and the only other, you know, he's not a particularly well-educated man. The only thing he knows how to do is draw. So he goes looking for a newspaper. Takes him a little while to get a job, but he eventually lands with the New York Globe, which at the time was the oldest newspaper in North America, drawing sports stories. And he was very, very good at it. He was able to capture motion in his drawings, which at the time was, you know, completely made him different than everybody else. And it was based on his having played the game that he understood, you know, what the muscles did when you swung the bat or threw the ball. Very successful in New York, becomes a fairly, you know, big name Broadway celebrity. And 1918, he produces his first Believe It or Not cartoon. You know, and when I say that, it's just the title across the top. It's still mainly sports oriented, but it's focusing on sports guys that, you know, weren't in the news, you know, the lighter side of sports, I guess you'd call it today. And it's a fairly successful little panel that the editor starts saying, well, why don't you do this on a regular basis? And over a couple years, it becomes more important than, you know, the regular sports story. 1922, he takes his first trip around the world, and he gets introduced to culture in all its forms, religion, architecture, food, language. And he writes a daily diary from all the places that he's traveling, and he titles it Believe It or Not. And he's basically reporting from the far ends of the earth with a little bit of text, but mainly in a visual format.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think this is something that wouldn't happen today. As you mentioned, back then, photography wasn't widespread, And the world was kind of a bigger and more remote place. So in contemporary terms, you almost can't imagine this today. The idea was Ripley's editor said, hey, we're going to send you on this cruise around the world to draw cartoons of all these things that people had no idea existed. People wouldn't just regularly get photographs from places like India. So this I think, probably did jumpstart the believe it or not concept as the way that we know it today. He saw some things that fascinated him.
Absolutely. And because he was not formally educated himself, everything fascinated him. So he's writing with a gee golly sort of attitude and shock and surprise. And he's right. Most of America doesn't know what he's talking about. So they're following him quite religiously because it's all new to them. And he's presenting it in a very fun way that, you know, it's education with entertainment on the side. And in 1929, he puts a bunch of these stories into book form. And the book is a runaway bestseller success. And William Randolph Hearst, who was one of the richest men in the world and the absolute tycoon of the media business, hires Ripley. And from that point on, he's not just a New York celebrity, he's a world celebrity. And very quickly, he gets into radio, he gets into auditoriums, he does public speaking, he does a series of movies, and the empire grows tremendously during the 1930s. That, you know, virtually everything he tries, he succeeds at, and it's very much a Horatio Alger-type success story.
We're talking with Edward Meyer. He is the VP of Exhibits and Archives for the Ripley Entertainment Corporation. He acquires some of these, believe it or not, artifacts that you might see at a Ripley's auditorium nowadays or see in some of their books. On Tuesday, PBS will air a documentary about the life of Robert Ripley as part of their American Experience series. So, Edward, one of the things that's fascinating to me is that Robert Ripley's rise to fame all happened during the Depression. So what was it about Ripley at this time that really caught people's fancy when it was hard times in the United States?
Well, I think there's two things there. First, it lifts them from the Depression. It's a little bit of sunshine in the midst of the clouds. But more importantly, it's their chance for what Andy Warhol called 15 minutes of fame. The cartoon is full of personal little stories, and Ripley has big national contests to get people to tell them their stories. And, you know, there's nothing comparable at the time to seeing your name in the Ripley cartoon. You know, I, Edward Meyer, have a two-headed calf born on my farm. That is the highlight of many people's lives. And people, years later, that's in their obituary that they once appeared in Ripley's, believe it or not. It was that popular. And I think it really made people smile and bound together at a time where it was pretty grim and there wasn't too many things that could make them smile.
He had an open invitation for people to send him their weird stories and claims, and it even caused a bit of a fervor of how people would submit them.
Well, we still do that. I like to call it the you know, sort of dawn of social media, that Ripley understood that the people that were reading his column were everyday people with personal stories, and he gave them an opportunity to tell their story. And he literally invited people to do so. And today we do the same through our web pages. You know, write to Ripley's, tell us your story. If you got something that's worth our buying, you know, let us know. But he offered some contest prizes that were very appealing at the time, trips to Havana, Cuba, contest in 1932. The first prize was, you know, an airplane. People don't even have cars, and he's offering an airplane. So there's a big, big general following based on the chance of being famous.
Let's talk a little bit about his fame. We kind of all remember the cartoons and we're familiar with that, but he was very unique in that this was a multimedia thing. He decided to take it from just the newspapers into radio. The radio program was immensely popular, but then onto a stage show where he employed people that might otherwise just be in some kind of traveling carnival or something to display their oddities. But also then he was an early figure on television.
The radio show starts in 1930, and it's a weekly show, second only to Jack Benny for many years, continuous for 14 straight years, then interrupted by World War II. Then he comes back on for three more years, and then the radio show leads directly into television in 1949. The Ripley show ended up running for 3 years, but Robert Ripley himself actually had a heart attack live on the air on the 13th show in 1949, ends up dying in the hospital 3 days later. But so he's actually voted the most popular man in America at the height of his career, and he's an international star comparable to anybody today. I mean, he couldn't go anywhere without being mobbed on the street by the paparazzi, photographs of him doing anything and everything. He's as much beloved, autograph-seeking, and everything he does is media attention-worthy. He was a pioneer in on-location broadcasting, so people are tuning in to find out where Ripley is tonight.
And after World War II, he did a live broadcast from Hiroshima.
Yeah, he was one of the first Americans back into Hiroshima at some risk to his life. And his last trip was in May of 1948, 1 year before he ends up dying. And he went to Hawaii, the Philippines, Japan, and China, and specifically did radio broadcasts from war-torn areas and reported back to America what World War II had done to the Orient.
And as you mentioned, it sounds like a believe-it-or-not story, but he had that heart attack that ended up ending his life. He actually suffered that heart attack while he was on TV live.
Yes, and ironically, it's the 13th show, and he was reporting on the military funeral march of Taps at the time he collapsed. So great, great irony in his death scene, even.
Well, Robert Ripley's story is told on the PBS show The American Experience, airing here locally on Tuesday at 9. We've been talking with Vice President of Exhibits and Archives for the Ripley Company, who carries on the legacy of Robert Ripley, Edward Meyer. Edward, thanks for being with us today.
All right. Well, thank you. And if I can, we're also going to do a Reddit AMA from 7 to 8:30 prior to the show. And we will be live tweeting during the show. So if any of your listeners have questions about Ripley's, Tuesday night is a big night for us.
Moving the Ripley empire even to more media. Edward Meyer, thanks for being with us to talk about it this morning.
All right. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. We're going to be back after this. It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC.